But, you know, this is going to be more of a less of a survey talk, and of course Professor Holebo and Professor Hirota and probably a lot of other people know most of what's in this already. So let's see. How do I get to the next one? Okay, so how many capacities does a quantum channel have? Everyone probably knows the classical channel has essentially one capacity. So for quantum channels, today in my talk I'm going to mention, well, accessible information, which is the capacity that Chris was talking about before people realized it was superconductivity. And I'll talk about the classical capacity and something called the Holebo capacity, which we don't know if these are really different, and that's why I'm calling labeling them 3 and 3.5. And in between them, several years ago, I discovered something called adaptively accessible information, or you could also call this the LOCC, so local operations and classical communication capacity. And, you know, it's been around for a while, but I thought, you know, I'm not sure how many people have seen this, so I'm going to spend, you know, some time on this. And there's some interesting open questions connected with this, and I'll mention those. And then there's the entanglement assisted capacity, the quantum capacity of a quantum channel. And you can also add a feedback channel from the receiver to the sender. And that does not improve the capacity of the classical channel, but it does improve the appears to improve the capacity of a quantum channel. We know it improves the classical capacity of a quantum channel, and in fact, it also improves the quantum capacity of a quantum channel. And so you can also ask about the capacity, quantum and classical, with an extra side check. And actually, this is a little tricky. If you ask for a capacity of a classical channel with a classical side channel, well, if you want to send classical information, you don't even have to use the classical. I mean, if you have a classical side channel, couldn't you just send all the classical information of the classical side channel and ignore the quantum channel? So you have to be careful when you're accounting, you know, you have to be careful when you take this into account, and I'll talk about that some more. So we'll start with a quote from Claude Shannon in his 1948 paper, which essentially started the field of information theory. And he says, the fundamental problem of communication is that of reproducing at one point, either exactly or approximately, a message selected at another point. And so, well, this is what we're talking about. So 25 years later, and John Pierce, I believe Chris Fuchs came up with this quote, and I really like it. So this was in a retrospective after 25 years of information theory. And one of the amazing things about this set of retrospective papers is that at this time, people thought information theory was virtually solved. And the reason they thought information theory was virtually solved was that, you know, 25 years had gone by. They had done all the theory. There wasn't really very much practice yet because computers were too slow for all of these techniques to really be useful. And what happened was that as soon as computers started getting faster, people tried to apply these things, and they realized that it wasn't actually solved. There were tons of open questions and ways to improve things and stuff. So as soon as computers started actually being fast enough to use information theory, they realized the theory wasn't sufficient and that they needed a lot more theory to make things work in practice. And in fact, they're still working on it. So I want to say, you know, I want to contrast this situation to the situation of quantum computing and quantum information and say that as soon as we get real quantum computers and things fast enough to make, you know, these things all practical, we realize that we really don't know as much about the subject as we thought we could.
Right. Yeah, so it hasn't been 20 years, and people don't consider quantum computing a dead subject yet.
Well, had Pierce met Holebo?
What? No, Pierce had come up. This was the same year that Holebo published his first paper about the quantum capacity of a of the classical capacity of a quantum channel. So, you know, it's been 25 years later, and physicists have stopped talking about reformulating information theory, and we still don't know the
general expression for the capacity of a channel with quantum effects taken into account. Although I think we're getting there. So, So here we are with Shannon's channel coding theorem. I'll go over it for those of you in the audience who don't know this. So we have to define entropy. So the entropy of a signal which takes value I with probability p sub I is summation I minus p sub I log p sub I. And the noisy channel N has capacity, the mutual information between the input and the output maximized over all probability distributions on the input, where mutual information is just defined to be the entropy of the output minus the entropy of the output given the input, which can be reformulated or is equivalent to the entropy of the input plus the entropy of the output minus the joint entropy of the input and the output. Okay. So what happens when you go to quantum situation? Well, if you have a quantum state, you know, if you have n photons, each in one of two orthogonal states, all of these states are completely distinguishable. And in fact, if there's a measurement that will tell you which one it is, so there's 2^n possible states, and the entropy is log of that, which is n bits. In the quantum case, if you have n photons, either in state this or something that's not, you know, not orthogonal, but not the same one either, with probability 1/2. So if the angle between these polarizations is small, any two of these states are not that distinguishable. And intuitively, you'd think the entropy should be a lot less than n bits. And if that von Neumann gave the formula for the entropy, so if you have a quantum system with density matrix rho, the entropy is minus trace of rho log rho, which is just the Shannon entropy of the eigenvalue. So you can ask, does this give the right capacity of the quantum channel? And historically, the people who looked at it first said, well, clearly, no. And the reason they said no is, well, suppose we have a source. So I'm going to formulate this a little bit differently because than you used to, because I'm going to get into this, you know, adaptively accessible information. And I think this report, thinking of it differently, is a good way to think about adaptively accessible information. So suppose we have a source that outputs sequence rho sub I with probability p sub I. How much Shannon information can we extract about the sequence of I's? So somewhere inside this source, there's a classical record that says what these signals are. And we're assuming these signals are independent and identical. And we want to know how much we can learn about this classical record. So what is the measurement of this thing which will give us the minimum uncertainty about what this classical record is, or maximize the mutual information between the output of our measurement and the classical record? Well, let X be the random variable setting which of these signals rho sub I was sent. The answer from classical information theory is optimized over all possible measurements M on the signals with outcomes M1, M2, et cetera, which maximizes of the mutual information between the source and the measurement outcome. So you look at all measurements on a single thing, and you maximize this accessible information. So what does that give you? Well, there's only two states in the ensemble, 1, 0 and cos theta sine theta, then the density matrix is this, and you can, you know, find the eigenvalues, and the eigenvalues are 1/2 plus or minus cosine theta over 2. So if you, you know, if this were, you know, things behaved as in the classical realm, you would think that the mutual inspiration, maximum mutual inspiration is, you know, minus pi log pi, where these one half plus or minus cosine theta over 2 is t sub I. So that's just what this h is, the binary entropy standard. And that's the optimal measurement, is the von Neumann measurement, where you put you put it symmetrically around these two states. Okay. And so now you can compare the mutual information you get from this measurement, which is defined as accessible information, and entropy. And you see that except when the angle is 0 or pi over 2, which means they're either indistinguishable states or perfectly distinguishable states, the accessible information is less than this mutual information. So it looks like the Shannon bound really doesn't work. Well, let's look at another example because, okay, I'm going to skip over the POVM measurement slide. Everyone knows what a POVM is. We'll look at a second example. Suppose you have three states that differ by 6 feet. So 1 and minus 1 half plus or minus root 3 over 2. What's the optimal measurement for maximizing accessible information? Well, there's a POVM which corresponds to the three vectors WI, which are according to the B sub I. And if you get, say, this outcome, then you know that this signal was not sent, but it could equally likely have been this one or this one. So each outcome rules out exactly one state, and this gives the accessible information as log 3 minus 1, which is 0.585 bits. And the entropy, again, is of this density matrix is 1 bit. So again, the mutual information, the accessible information is less than the entropy. So you might think there's a theorem in here. And indeed, Professor Holebo proved a theorem in, I don't know, was it 1973? Somewhere around there, which says that if you have a source that emits rho sub I with probability p sub I, you can define this entropy of the average output minus the average entropy of the output. And this is what the mutual information is in classical, you know, in classical information theory, the mutual information, or one of the two formulas I gave for classical mutual information, was the entropy of the average output minus the average entropy of the output. And the theorem is that the accessible information is always less than the Holebo information. And if all of the rho sub I commute, then the situation is classical and they're equal, and otherwise it's strictly less. So how can we use an ensemble of quantum states to send classical information? Well, once we've chosen the measurement, what we have is a classical channel. And so suppose we choose this measurement. Shannon's classical coding theory says that Alice can find a codebook using states from the ensemble such that she can asymptotically send Bob the accessible information bits per state. So let's continue with example 2 again. If we look at just 2 of the 3 signal states, then the optimal measurement for 2 vectors, well, we know that already. It's 1 minus the entropy of 1 half plus root 3 over 2, or 0.6454. And this is larger than if we used all 3 of the states. So here, you know, we can do better by using 2 of these states. So let's go back and look at the situation again, where in the other view, where there's a source that's outputting all this information, all these three states with equal probabilities. Can we get this amount of information out of that source? The answer is no. But we can, in some sense, if we use extra resources. So can Alice use, so suppose Alice knows this source. Is there any way she can help Bob extract information from the source? Well, she can give him hints. So for the 3 vector ensemble of 12, Alice, for each of these source outputs, she can narrow Bob's possibilities down to 2 vectors, and then he can use the optimal measurement to distinguish between them. So this lets them extract more information from the reduced state. So let's say that Alice sends Bob a hint for each of these things. So is there chalk somewhere? And yes, the chalk is underneath the desk. No, these are batteries.
Okay. All right, so let's go through this without chalk. Okay, so you can give hints. So for the pre-vector,
For each transmission, Alice can narrow Bob's possibilities down to two vectors, and then he can use the optimal measurement to distinguish between these. So if Alice sends Bob extra classical information, he can extract more information, even after subtracting the extra amount of classical information from the source. Yeah?
Classical coding theorem. It's for very long block codes.
Right.
Right. So you're not forced to deduce the information one use at a time.
Yes.
And here I think we're not fully we're not using many uses of the channel at one time, right? We're talking about single states, not sending entangled states for multiple uses. Can you clarify? But then we're talking about a classical result. We're saying, well, we can use classical channel capacity once we define a measurement, and that is an asymptotic.
Right.
So can you clarify which ones are asymptotics and which ones are single shot?
So for this model, what we really have to do is we have to say, well, we're only allowed to measure one signal at a time. So you can think of all these signals as being different laboratories, and we can't measure two of them at once. But then we're allowed to use local, classical communication between the various labs to decode this. So let's say this is going to be, so the signals are signals. Different labs. So we can measure each lab, and then we use classical communication.
Do all the measurements have to be made before the labs start to communicate with each other, or can one of the labs make a measurement, talk to the other one, and tell them what measurement to make?
Let me get more specific about that later. So there's two different possibilities. That gives you two different channel capacities. This doesn't happen for classical probability distributions because
that's a kind of a Monty Hall question here. Because you say even subtracting the extra information, if you count that in the crudest way of saying one trip of the hint, then that's an enormous amount of it.
Right.
So you'd have to subtract it
in the amount of actual information that Alice has sent, which I know she has three possibilities. She can say it's not A, it's not B, it's not C.
Yeah.
But for each each source, she can only have to send two. And she can send two of these three possibilities. So the amount of extra information is log 3 minus log 2. Okay. So now we can ask, and this is where this non-entity that Chris was talking about comes in. We can ask, is there more information you can send using, if you want to send information using these three,
three states, each at an angle of 120 degrees, is this 0.6454 number the most information we can send? And the answer is no. You can use tensor products of these states as code words. So how would you do better? You would use three code words, V1T with tensor V1, V2 tensor V2, and V3 tensor V3. So these are three states in a four-dimensional space, because each of these vectors is a qubit. But of course, these three states lie in a three-dimensional subspace of this four-dimensional space, and they have the same angle between all of them, which is their inner product is a half. So this and this and this are something like what they look like. And the optimal measurement to get the most accessible information out of these three things is these three von Neumann, you know, this von Neumann measurement with these three orthonormal states, which are gotten essentially by taking these three things and pulling them apart till they're 90 degrees from each other. And you can calculate how much information this gives you. And it's 1.309 bits, which is more than twice. Oh, no, it's 1.369 bits, which is more than twice 0.6545, which is the most you could do if you just restricted measuring one signal at a time. So this is, this gives you an improvement. Well, I mean, if measuring two things at a time is better than measuring one, clearly, sending code words of length 3 or length 4 or length 5 and doing some joint measurement on them is going to be better than 2. What? So clearly, we want to find the limit as n goes to infinity. So what is this limit as n goes to infinity? And the answer goes back to this. Well, we had this bound saying you couldn't possibly do more than this quantity chi, which Holevo defined. And the limit actually is this quantity chi. So one possible capacity formula for sending signals with states rho sub I is maximized over all probability distributions chi of the Holevo information of this ensemble of possible channel outputs. Okay. And how do we prove this theorem? Well, we essentially take the techniques of classical coding theory and turn them into quantum mechanical states. So classical coding theory, to prove Shannon's theorem, you choose a random code. You say that most sequences in this random code are what is known as typical sequences. So we can only worry about typical sequences. And these, you can count how many typical sequences you can distinguish. And probability theory tells you, it gives you Shannon's bound. So for the Holevo Schumacher Westmoreland theorem, you again use random coding. You take random tensor products of these states, and you choose a code book of the appropriate number of random tensor products of these states. And then you say that most of these tensor products lie close to something called the typical subspace. And you find a measurement which will distinguish between them. And this measurement is what's known as a square root measurement, or a pretty good measurement, which I'm not going to tell you what it is. And you also need to use conditionally typical subspaces because you have, if the signals are mixed states rather than pure states, then each sequence of signals actually gives you a typical subspace and not a single state. And you want to distinguish this typical subspace, and that forces you to do conditionally typical subspaces. And it's a little bit complicated, but it works. And let's go back and look at this tensor product of two copies of example 2. How can you extract the most information from it? So suppose, again, you have a source emitting sequences of V1, V2, V3 with all equal probabilities. Well, Alice will send Bob the difference between the two labels. Now we want to look at code words of length 2. So, and we know if the code words were V1, V1, V2, V2, or V3, V3, we could make a pretty good measurement. So now for this tensor product two states, Alice could send Bob the difference between the labels on the two states. So she could send V1, V1, or V2, V2, or V3, V3. Or she could send the difference as 1. So that would narrow it down to this, which is the same thing, except you've rotated the second state, or this. And each of these three ensembles has a measurement yielding 1.369 bits. So again, if you know, if you have a source which is outputting random things, and you're allowed to have hits, you can get the whole label information. Actually, I should say this is a proof. This is a example, not a proof, and I don't know if anyone has actually written down a proof for this, but it shouldn't be very hard. So far, we have examples where the amount of information we can extract from an ensemble is the average of the accessible information for some ensembles, and as we let the n go to infinity, this presumably goes to the whole label information. But suppose we're only allowed to measure one thing at a time. Is the best we can do find some set of sub-ensembles, and then Alice figures out which of the sub-ensemble the state is in, sends Bob this information, and then Bob measures it. And the answer we can do is better. So now I want to go back to this LOCC state where we're not allowed joint measurement on signals.
There's a theorem that if you allow hints, you can get the whole label information.
Right.
How are you defining a hint? Because if the hint is telling you everything, then you definitely get the label information.
Okay, so the hint. So Alice has to take the hint and encode it in some number of qubits. And now Bob, and now you have to take Bob. He has some mutual information between the source and his measurement. You subtract the number of qubits that Bob, that Alice sent.
The hint is a quantum hint or a bit?
A classical hint. It's a string of bits. And of course, in order to use this term, Alice has to use data compression to compress these bits down to her smallest amount to the smallest amount of actual information.
But so in that example, the hint is one trip.
No, the
you
hint
said
is,
which of these three cases you're
yeah,
in.
Yeah, in that example, the hint is one trip.
And the amount you get out is 1.36 or whatever. So your increase is only 0.36.
Let's see. The hint is one trip. The amount of information you get out is... No, the amount of information you get out is 1.369 plus the amount of hint. Because with a hint and Alice's thing, Bob now has 1.369 plus what he got from the measurement. Because, you know, what this measurement does is it tells Bob which of these three things that's in. So Bob, this hint of one trip actually gives Bob one trip of information about the source. And now you ask how much more information you get out.
So should I think of this as the related capacity with a side channel? Or can you send the hint using this channel itself in some complex way?
Well, so this channel is actually so you'd have to change the rules to send a hint using this channel. And but you know, if you change the rules to let me send this hint using the channel, then it might work. So we're going to get back to something like this. So where are we? How do we do better?
Well, I have an example where Bob can do better using two measurements sequentially. So let's look at this example made up of the ensemble of three-dimensional states. So we had this, you know, these three states in the plane. And now what we're going to do is we're going to lift each of these out of the plane by some small angle, which is something like cosine of alpha here. Well, actually sine of alpha. So we'll have the three-dimensional states, beta, zero, alpha. You know, the state 120 degrees of that, and the first two qubits and alpha, or the first two coordinates, and then alpha, and then the state minus 120 degrees away, and the first two coordinates and alpha.
So we've taken these three states and lifted them up by an angle of, I think, sine alpha. Arcsine alpha. Yeah. So for these three states and small alpha, it turns out turned down to extract more than the accessible information for any probability. So if we're only allowed to measure these states one at a time, we're calculating that. So how does our protocol, so we're not allowed to make joint measurements, but we're allowed to do, you know, any sequence of local quantum operations and classical representations. Well, let's consider these just two-step measurements. First, I'm going to make a measurement, which here projects these free states into the plane or lifts them further out of the plane. So you can think of the measurement, you know, there's a measurement which says either after this we get, well, this isn't the optimal thing to do, but let's either, there is a measurement which will take them either to 90 degree angles or project them into the plane. And if they're projected into the plane, then Bob asks Alice to narrow the choice down to two possibilities, and then he can make the optimal measurement distinguishing them. And if they're lifted out of the plane, and if you lift them all the way up to where they're orthogonal, then he can make an optimal measurement distinguishing all three of them. And now you can ask, well, how much information does he get? Well, he gets, you know, 0.6454, or was it 6545? You know, the optimal information for distinguishing two of them in this case, and the optimal information for distinguishing all three of them in this case. And if you average them out, it turns out to be more than the optimal measurement on these three. The optimal measurement on these three actually is something which says, it turns out to be more than the optimal, you know. If you were just had these three states and you had to make one measurement, you could ask how well, how much information could you send? And the amount of, and the right answer there is to nearly all the time send one of these two states, and then with some very small probability send this state. And then Alice and Bob makes this measurement, which most of the time, well, which distinguishes between these two states. So you make a measurement where you're essentially two a von Neumann measurement, where it's essentially most of the time you're in this plane caused by these two states. But every so often you get a result which is out of this plane. And that is a little bit better than, that's a little bit better than ignoring this and just using these two states. But it's not as good as this two-part measurement, yeah?
Sender of the information here?
Alice is still the sender.
Okay, so for this requires feedback from Bob to Alice?
This requires feedback from Bob to Alice.
Okay.
Well, actually, it turns out it doesn't. But right now, it does. This explanation, it does.
Okay, so if it did before, when Alice sent the hint, we subtracted the cost that, one trade river. Yeah, how much do we charge? What's the cost?
Well, wait, the cost is, you know, for sending one bit forward, the cost is one. For sending a bit backward, the cost is free.
Okay, so feedback is going to be free in this case.
Okay. Okay. So the question is, can we use this protocol for extracting information from
Can we use this protocol without the backwards, the feedback channel? And the answer is yes. And this gets a little bit tricky. And I did not prepare the slide, so I'm going to try to explain it on the board. So what Alice is going to do is going to take two random codes. And one of these codes is 102101. And the other of these codes is 10110101010. And add mod 3 23111202 0 to 0. So 2 plus 1 is 0. So she, so this, so there's a random code. You're adding triplies. So this random code is, what do I want to say? I want to say this random code is, you choose some number of random codes on a crit alphabet, and you choose some number of random codes of the bit alphabet, and the code book Alice uses, she adds them together, and this gives you a set of code words, and she chooses one of these at random, and encodes the, for this she sends state 2, this she sends state 1, etc. So this is Alice's, this is a signal Alice sends. So what does Bob do? Well, what Bob does is first he does this measurement, which either projects these things upwards to, the optimal thing to do is not project them upwards till they're orthogonal, but project them upwards till they're less, they're more orthogonal than they were originally, but not all the way orthogonal. But let's assume that she projects them up until they're all orthogonal, because it makes it easier to talk about, but it still works. Okay, so either he projects them up until they're all orthogonal, or he projects them into the state. So some of these are now, these are three-dimensional, and others are two-dimensional. So now let's assume that he ignores the ones that were projected into the plane and just looks at this three-dimensional thing. Well, what kind of classical channel does this look like? Well, this looks like a classical channel where, zero either goes to zero or one with probably 50%, and then erased with probability P. So if Alice put in a code word here, it gets taken to one of two code words, and then it gets erased because we're ignoring everything here. So what you do is you choose this code word, so this channel has some classical capacity. So you chose this thing, this top code words, so that the amount of information Bob gets by just measuring the state that had been projected out of the plane is equal to, so that he can tell exactly which code word this is by measuring those states. Now, by measuring those states, he now can take this set of results and knows this, so he now knows that each of these is, no, what I want to say is that after measuring this, he now has a choice of two possibilities for each of the guys measured in the plane. So he can now, that he's narrowed them down to two possibilities, he can use the optimal measurement for that. And that lets him decode this code, second code. So by this two-step process, Bob has now gotten, has now decoded the code word Alice sent. And once he's decoded the code word Alice sent, he's gotten the information, and that lets you send information faster than the accessible information, still using only local operations and classical communication. Now, by terms of classical coding theory, you can show that you cannot achieve this rate unless you do something like measure one of the states partially, and then use this result to measure another state, and then use a third result to refine the measurement on the first state to, so you need to make partial measurements and then use a residual measurement on some of these states to achieve this capacity. And of course, that's exactly what we've done when we take this thing and first either project it up or into the plane and then further refine this measurement. So this is this, adaptively accessible capacity, which is between the classical capacity or the, yeah, the, between the Halevo capacity and the accessible information, yeah?
I understood that. Does that mean that in addition to needing communication between the different laboratories,
right,
it's not sufficient to have sort of one way down the chain communication? I really do have to have bidirectional communication to achieve this?
That's exactly what I said.
Okay.
All right, that's exactly what I meant to say. Obviously, I didn't quite say it.
I'm sorry, I should have written it.
Yeah.
So is there another capacity that's between this and the no communication capacity where you only go forward down the chain?
If you only go forward down the chain, you get the no communication capacity.
Oh, you can't get anything else.
You can't get anything else. But, you know, this gives us two additional capacities. You have this one where Bob, you know, Alice takes a code word, sends everything to Bob, and then Bob, you know,
does all these, you know, back and forth measurements and communications. And one where, you know, you have Bob, give Bob a back channel to Alice, which is free, and Alice a side channel to Bob, which she has to pay for, and then ask, how much is that? And you can ask, are these two things the same? And I don't know. They are different if you take these two things and generalize to, well, I mean, so quantum, you know, if you have a quantum state, it's, you can think of it as a classical black box where you're allowed to make one measurement, and then depending on the results of this measurement, either you're allowed to make another measurement or not. You can think of this as a classical black box where you can push buttons and strange things going on inside. And you can ask, well, what is the information capacity for classical black boxes where you're allowed to push buttons and have strange things go on inside and have readouts? And in the case of classical black boxes, I'm pretty sure, I don't know if I've really proved it, but I have a set of black boxes where these are definitely different. But for, or at least I think they're different, but for quantum states, I don't know if they're different or not. Okay. Now, I seem to have used up nearly all my time, so let's go through this. Okay, that's the quantum channel. So what have we have so far? Well, we have unentangled inputs, separate measurements, and this is the accessible information. We have unentangled input and adaptive separate measurements. So you make a measurement, then you do some classical logic on the results of all these measurements, make a further measurement, maybe do some more classical logic, make a further measurement, et cetera. And so for this set of states, you only needed one round of classical logic, but you can stick as many rounds as you win, and you can ask, well, yeah, these are the questions I just asked. Does this increase if you allow a feedback channel from Bob to Alice, and a classical side channel from Alice to Bob that must be paid for, et cetera? And then there's unentangled inputs joint measurement. And so now, once you've gotten here, there's an obvious question. Suppose you allow entangled inputs and joint measurements.
It's a bit more striking, if you don't mind.
OK.
So as I told the story, Halevo pointed out his 1978 paper where he considered the question on Peter's last transparency.
The previous one, you mean?
The previous one.
Yeah.
And then, so this meeting was great. But soon after that, we were talking at some point, and Bennett and Smolin and I were starting to consider this question where we entangle the inputs. And I talked to Halevo, and I said, what do you know about this? And he said, I don't know. I've never considered this question. And I said, why not? And he said, one thing at a time. But that just, I think, makes it a little more striking, the two communities that came together at that
point. Yeah.
Old quantum information and new quantum information.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And of course, this is the, you know, now very famous additivity question. Is this chi of n1 tensor n2 equal to chi of n1 plus chi of n2, for example?
And you know, I should say that a few years ago, I proved that this was equivalent to additivity of entanglement of formation, additivity of the minimum output entropy for quantum channels, and strong superadditivity of entanglement of formation. And since then, it's been shown that it's also equivalent to the additivity of minimum output entropy for uniform channels, And I think there may be a few more equivalences now. So this is now a very important open question, which last year, Andreas and Winter demolished their only, demolished the most promising path of attack on it by showing that a generalization of this to, I guess, Renyi entropy does not work. Yes?
Illusion.
What?
I think you only demolish the illusion.
The illusion. He demolished the illusion path of attack. Because we now know that the attack is never type. And I guess it's not just Andreas Minter, it's also fabricated. But he codes the cause. We now know the path of attack is not going to work. So, what things might increase the capacity of a quantum channel
which don't affect this? And one thing is prior entanglement shared between the sender and receiver. And you can show this. And so if you have, OK, I'm going to have to go through these slides pretty quickly. But if you have prior entanglement, you now have a new formula. The capacity is the maximum of the entropy. Well, you take your input, and you assume you have one piece that Alice keeps and one piece that Alice sends to the channel. And this, you know, is phi. So then you take the entropy of the piece that Bob gets plus the entropy of the piece that Alice keeps minus the entropy of the joint state, which is a generalization of the other formulation of classical mutual information or classical capacity. And that gives you entanglement assisted capacity. And now you can ask all sorts of things. So suppose you ask, well, we have one case where the sender sends, one capacity where the sender sends information without, one capacity where the sender sends information without any entanglement, and one capacity where the sender sends information using as much entanglement between the sender and receiver as she needs. So suppose she has a limited amount of entanglement, but not as much as she really would like. Well, suppose your entanglement is even. How much does she say? Well, what you do is you maximize over rho sub I the average entropy of the input minus the entropy of the average output, or plus the entropy of the average output, minus the average entropy of the joint state. So this is a generalization of the previous one, where instead of, you know, instead of having one pure state that Alice sends to the channel, she has a bunch of pure states. And the amount of entanglement she uses is the average entropy of the input. And so this interpolates smoothly between the Holevo-Schumacher-Westmoreland capacity and the entanglement assisted capacity. And we don't know whether this is additive either. So you have to regularize it, which means you, you know, take the tensor product of n copies of the channel and apply this formula to the channel, which is the tensor product of n copies of the original channel. So, yeah. And let's skip this. We also have the quantum capacity of a quantum channel, which is how much quantum information you can send through it. And no, here's another famous formula, which is called the coherent information. And so now you can ask questions as, for a given channel n with amount of E shared entanglement, how many qubits can you send and how many classical bits can you send if you want to send some amount of classical information and some amount of quantum information? And there are some beautiful results on this kind. In the father formula, you can have C equals 0 and E shared entanglement and Q quantum information, where E is this formula and Q is this formula, which you can just express more simply as E is 1/2 the mutual information between Alice and the environment, and Q is 1/2 the information between Alice and Bob after you put a state through the quantum channel. And the great thing about the father formula is you can combine it with superdense coding to get the entanglement and system capacity formula. So you use the father formula, and this sends quantum bits. But now you say, well, and now I have quantum bits. I can use superdense coding to turn those into classical bits with some extra entanglement. And this gives the formula for entanglement assisted capacity. And you can also, you know, if you have combine it with a transmission of EPR pairs. So if you're sending quantum capacity, well, this says, this formula says you use some number of quantum states and you use that, some number of EPR pairs, and you use them to get some number of quantum states transmitted. Well, if you're transmitting more quantum states than the amount of EPR pairs you started with, you can use some of these quantum states you're transmitting to form more EPR pairs. And then you don't need to use any EPR pairs because you're just forming them and then going back and reusing them. So this gives you the, when you plug that in, that gives you the quantum channel capacity formula. So this father, this protocol has two children, which is why it's called the father protocol. And there's a mother protocol with three children, where instead of having a noisy channel, you have an entangled, mixed entangled state. And you know, these resource inequalities have give you all, you know, there's, you know, all sorts of really neat research going into resource inequalities like this. Okay, and the last thing I wanted to say is, well, we'll revisit the question of what things might increase the capacity of the quantum channel and which things don't affect it. Well, does entanglement between different uses affect it? The answer is we don't know. We've already seen that prior entanglement between the sender and receiver helps. Now, how about a classical back channel from the receiver to the sender? It turns out this helps too. But for this to help, you need to use entanglement between different channel uses. If you don't use entanglement between different channel uses, it doesn't help. And when does a back channel help? This is research I've done with, you know, collaborators at IBM. And we found this very funny kind of channel, which you can show it helps if you have a feedback channel. And the name we're using them, I think, is retrocorrectable channels, which, well, what you do is you have a control bit, and the channel measures the control bit in a random basis and then uses it to perform a unitary operation on the data set. And the receiver gets the basis this measurement was taken in and the data bit after the unitary operation. Now, if the receiver knew the results of the measurement, then if the receiver knew the results of this measurement, then he could undo this and get as much quantum information as he wanted to. But suppose he doesn't know the results of this measurement, which is the case in this channel. He just knows the basis this was measured in. Well, then, and it was a random basis, so Alice can't. No, if he knew the basis that this was going to be measured in, Alice could just put basis vector in this basis in, and then he would know the unitary operation, and he could send qubits on this data bit perfectly. But he doesn't know which basis it's going to be measuring, so no matter what basis Alice puts in, it's going to be pretty much scrambled, which means this is going to be a pretty much random unitary operation, which means this is going to be pretty much noise. So how can he help? Well, suppose there's feedback. Well, Alice puts into the control bit, she puts an EPR pair, and she keeps half of it and puts the other half into this control bit. Then Bob gets the basis. He sends Alice back classically with a feedback channel the basis, and now Alice measures her control bit, and she gets what operation was performed. So then Alice has to send him the which basis element was measured, and then he can decode this. So Alice has to send the basis element, then he gets perfect information. So for Alice to send him the basis element, she's going to use some of these data bits to send the basis element. But it turns out this, so using the data bits decreases to send this information about the basis element decreases the capacity of the channel, but not as much as, you know, but, you know, if you have a random control bit, then you don't have to be based. This is a random control bit. This is pretty much completely random. So Bob has, you know, Bob gets absolutely no information, whereas if you use this forward capacity to send the results of Alice's measurement on this EPR pair, you actually get some capacity remaining. Yeah?
Different uses of the channel, though. It's only correlated.
It's only correlated.
Data in the next.
It's okay, yeah. But okay, so but Alice, okay, Alice puts in half of an EPR pair and keeps that. So it's not entangled.
She never gets it entangled in another use.
Right. So I guess I was wrong here. So this is not entanglement between different channel uses. This is entanglement between the signal she sends and what she keeps. Okay. So using the above type of constructions, we discovered that these eight capacities, quantum, classical, quantum with feedback, classical with feedback, quantum with a two-way side channel, classical with a two-way side channel, where, of course, we have to subtract the uses of two-way side channel from the amount of communication, we have to subtract the number of uses from the amount of number of bits sent to Bob. And these things are all different. Are actually, they all appear to be different. We haven't proven all of these different, although we can prove some of these different, assuming the additivity of classical capacity of the quantum channel. And because of superdense coding and teleportation, class C sub E is equal to 2 Q sub E, so with entanglement systems, this is twice this, and we get 6 different capacities. Okay, so that's, I think that's more or less the time I have, yeah?
Maybe I should save it until.
No, you can ask the question, I think.
Okay, fine.
But why don't we clap first?
Yes.
Public questions, and we ought to break for coffee. The listeners are not going to get coffee, but you've asked so many, Rob. Wait till the next time. Any other questions? Well, then, Robin.
Just a quick question. So, presumably, if the integrity conjecture is true, then all those inequalities become strict inequalities. But do you actually mean that we can prove that QE is never, for instance, accidentally equal to C?
Oh, no. QE can often be. These are strict inequalities for. There are channels for which these are strict, is what I should say. But there are also channels. For which these are all equal, or at least I mean, for any pair of these, there are channels for which these are equal. Like
they're all equal for the useless channel.
Yeah. For example. For the useless channel, they're all zero.
Did you mean 6 or 7 different capacities? Looks like 7.
I probably meant 7. Yeah.
Despite the repeated use of the Roman numeral for 6, there.
Oh, that's not 6. That's a better than going down. And obviously, I turned up, take a lesser angle and turned on the side. Obviously, I should have taken a greater angle and turned it 270 degrees. that would have looked like a Roman numeral 4, but I think that.
Okay, why don't we break for coffee? Come back in here at 10:30. Let's thank Peter Lohmann last time.